My name's Craig, and I'm an alcoholic.
Craig.
From Gilbert, Arizona. My home group is the Waddy group, the We Ain't Dead Yet group.
All right.
Got some of us here. Can we have a moment of silence and gratitude for the AA recoveries of the 75 years past? Followed by the Serenity Prayer. God. And this afternoon, we're going to have three speakers, and I've just met them myself, so I'm going to let them tell you all about themselves. And first of all, we're going to have Bill W. I'm not certain, but I don't think he's related to the co-founder. Bill.
Hi, everybody. I'm Bill. I'm an alcoholic. Really grateful to be sober today by the grace of the God that I found in Alcoholics Anonymous and in large part due to you people in the program, the fellowship in the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. I'm from Chicago, and I have a home group in Chicago. It's called Group 86A. A number of those guys are here this weekend. It's good to have them here with me. I have a sponsor. He's not here this weekend, but he's sponsored, and his sponsor is here this weekend, got to spend some time with him last night at the big meeting, which was cool. I need to thank Rick for sending me an invitation to speak. Thank you to GSO. A big thank you to my buddy Ruben over here, who actually I think hooked me up. So maybe that's a thank you, maybe it's not. We'll see. I'll tell you at the end of things. And thanks to the host committee. I mean, this is the first international. I've been sober. I'll tell you in a few minutes how long I've been sober. I've been sober a few 24 hours, and it's the first time I've made it to the international. And I don't know about you guys, but I'm just having I'm having the time of my life. I've talked to countless people from all over the country, all over the world, and been to some great meetings. And it's definitely been for me so far, and I'm sure it'll continue to be life-changing. Absolutely. I never thought when I got to AA that this was something that I would do. In fact, I think if you asked some people in Chicago AA that knew me like 9 years ago, they would have probably figured that I would not be sober, let alone be standing at a podium talking at an international. So grateful to be here. My sobriety date is July 15th, 1994. I'm going to talk about our common bond, which is our topic today. So I guess I'm going to talk about it. And what I've learned about it and what I think it means, you know, my opinions only, right? I've learned through sponsorship and going to a lot of meetings and through the literature that my belief in what our common bond is, that it's the suffering that we shared when we were out there, when we were in the throes of alcoholism, and it's the hope that we're able to give out once we recover, once we're in this program, you know, And in particular, I'm going to talk about, I was telling Ruben before the meeting that I read this article, and I don't remember how long ago I read it, and I Googled it last night trying to find it again so I could give the person that wrote it proper attribution, you know, so that you guys wouldn't think this is my words. These are definitely not my words. But she wrote a letter to the Grapevine, and in this letter she was really talking about a larger subject, which was the whole meaning of what identification is, you know, and how she got into a long, there was some motive behind what she was writing, and that she had a problem with, I'm an alcoholic and I'm not going there tonight. This afternoon. That's not what I'm going to talk about. But I thought what she said was really interesting is that she said that identification is the keystone of our common bond. That without being able to identify, at least for this alcoholic, without being able to identify with the guys that I met when I got into this program, there's no chance I'd be standing here today. Because had I gotten to Alcoholics Anonymous and not seen people that I believed, thought, felt, experienced the same things that I did, I don't think there would have been much motivation for me to stay around. That's just me. I don't think that. Well, I know that. I mean, I I've seen that come true with lots of people that have come to the program in the time that I've been sober. So I'm going to try and share my story with and kind of use that as a theme almost, is that talking about identification. Let me get this up here. I identified with drinkers from a very early age, not with sober people, because I don't know that I knew any. In fact, I'm fairly certain I didn't know any. In my family, drinking was like a sport almost. My father, not an alcoholic, but booze flowed very freely in my house. And so from an early age, I'd get sips of, you know, whatever drink was laying around. We'd be at a ball game. He'd give me a sip off his beer, whatever. And when his friends were in the house, I'd watch his friends drinking, and it just really seemed like an exciting thing to me, you know, that they were having fun. They used to have poker games in our basement, and I would sneak down to the top of the stairs where they couldn't see me, you know, and watch them down there and wish that I was doing that. And at some age, I can't even remember how old I was, he was like, why don't you mix drinks for the poker game, you know? And that was like the best thing that had happened to me, is that I got to hang out with them while they were playing cards and serve drinks, you know, and I couldn't have been more than 11, 12 years old. I don't think there's any way I could have been older than that, because that's probably about the time when the resentment for my father started to grow. And that's a different story we won't talk about today. But anyway, I identify with drinkers, and I still identify with drinkers, both the sober ones and the ones that are still drinking today. I'm in a business where, you know, from time to time we end up staying in a hotel, we're at some kind of a meeting, inevitably, I will end up sitting at the bar with the guys that are drinking, with the women that are drinking, because to me, they're the most interesting people in the room. I don't know about the rest of you, but drinkers are my people. So I identify with drinkers, you know, and I became one. I think I might have been in like seventh or eighth grade the first time I drank with the whole goal of getting drunk. You know, I was at a party with some older kids and one of them hooked me up with some, I think we were drinking some sort of dark rum, and I got drunk the first time, and I puked, and when I woke up the next morning not feeling too good, I was thinking right away, how soon can I do this again? And I hear that countless times from people at the podium, that first time, you know, the feeling that I got anyway, that first time that I picked up a drink, is something that maybe I'm chasing, maybe I'm just trying to get that feeling again, I don't know, but I liked the feeling, and I drank as often as I could from that point on, you know? And there was quite a while before it really caused a whole lot of consequences. I mean, I might get in trouble if I got caught. My dad had some kind of a cabinet, it didn't have a lock on it, I knew where the booze was, right? I'd go in there and take what I wanted, but no real consequences for quite a while. And so, you know, as time went on and I got older and it became more easy to get drunk, I spent a lot of time doing it. And I'm going to share a couple stories real quick. The things that started happening were things that were not expected in my family. I was a pretty smart kid, and my grades had always been pretty good from, you know, start first grade on, you know, and into the early part of high school, and it wasn't too long after that, as you know, it became more of a regular thing to drink, that my grades got crappy or went downhill anyway, and so my mother, who didn't really have a clue what was going on, my dad's the drinker in the family, his brothers, people on his side of the family more so than the people on my mother's side of the family. My mother didn't have a clue really what was going on, and my dad traveled a lot. So I could pull almost anything over my mom's eyes, and it was the proverbial, you know, wait till your dad gets home. And I wasn't real concerned about it, because sometimes he's gone a whole week, and I can wait a week, you know. I can deal with, you know, the trouble coming a week later, you know. I that consequence doesn't bother me too much. But, you know, things started happening. I started stealing, you know. My father had a box that he kept up on top of his dresser that he would put his winnings from poker and bowling would go in this box. And a lot of it would be singles, but there'd be fives, twenties, whatever in there. And he never kept a count on what was in there. So I would just go in there weekly pretty much and take out what I wanted, leave the rest. To this day, I don't know really that he's ever caught on. We talked about it a little bit when I made amends to him, and he just didn't seem to know what I was talking about. So I think I got over. You know, I stole. I was smoking cigarettes, and so we would go to the store, and we didn't have money except for the money I was stealing from my dad, so we would steal cigarettes, right? We'd steal cartons of cigarettes. We'd, and you know, and so I'm doing things that weren't, that in my family would not have been acceptable things to do. So I think that's the mindset of this alcoholic anyway, is that I can get away with stuff. As I got older and I went away to college, I carried that with me. You know, I got my first DUI when I was 18 years old. I got my second one when I was 20. So, you guys heard me say when I got sober, but I was 35 years old when I got sober. So if you do the math, I was like in the 70s when this stuff was happening, and you know, there wasn't a whole lot of harsh stuff with DUIs. You get the right lawyer, you get off, and both of those arrests got reduced to reckless driving. And so I didn't have to go to a class. I didn't have to, no community service. You know, my dad paid a fine, and I continue on as I always did. But I think that my mom was kind of starting to get a little bit of clue that something might not be right with this kid. I went away to college, and it took me 6 years to complete college. And it took me 6 years to complete college because I was drinking a whole lot more than I was studying. I used to get a check. My parents paid for my education pretty much. I mean, I had student loans and stuff, but they pretty much paid for my education. But I used to get a check every month from my grandmother, like $50 some months, $75 some months, and, you know, my friends would be waiting for my check to come, right, so that we could go out. So in the in-between, if we didn't get the check soon enough, we would go sell, what part of our blood were we, somebody out there can probably tell me, we'd sell our plasma, and you could go, I don't know how many days in a row you could go, but we would go as much as we could go to get the money that we needed to get drunk. And so it took me 6 years to complete college because I flunked out after two. I got another DUI in the year that I was flunked out of college. I went back to college. So all of this stuff's related to my drinking, but I pretty much was hanging around with people that I thought drank the same way I drank, you know, today, most of those guys that I went to college with, I have kept in some sort of contact with them because my ex-wife went to the same college that I did, and she keeps in close contact with them. Not so close for me, but all of them kind of just grew up, you know? They grew up. They got jobs, wives, responsibilities, and I didn't. So I had to go out looking for people. Again, it's that whole identification thing. Is I had to go out and find people that drank the way that I drank, and for the most part, I found those in bars. So, you know, I get out of college, I get married, I've got a job, a decent job, I've got responsibilities, but I'm spending a whole lot of time drinking mostly in bars and not really in nice bars. Not really a nice bar drinker. Because I didn't really identify with people that could drink responsibly. And if you go into a nice place, you know, you're going to find a lot of people that are sipping on wine or they're sipping on a cocktail. And I didn't drink that way. So I would go looking for the places where the fights might erupt, and especially places where I could become part of that family almost. In fact, the last bar that I drank in, the bar that I was drinking in when I got sober was, I was the only person that went to that place that was allowed to run a tab. Nobody else, because he got screwed over. The owner had gotten screwed over countless times. But he let me run a tab because I would come there Friday nights with my paycheck. He cashed my paycheck, took out what I owed him, gave me the rest, and then I would start a new tab, you know? When they would hire a new bartender, I was the first person the new bartender would get introduced to. Before the servers, before anybody else. This is Bill. He's part of the place. Get him what he wants. He can run a tab. You know, that's kind of how the way it went. So I pretty much lived my life in bars, and I identified with those who drank who drank that way, identified with the really a non-responsible lifestyle. I mean, I wasn't yet to that point where I was at where I was beyond. You know, I don't think I was yet at that point where I was beyond the help I was still probably where I could be reached by humans, except I wasn't looking to be reached. I had a wife who's at the time who's a wonderful woman who did not have a problem with alcohol, she slowly watched me deteriorate. When I got sober, she as part of the treatment program I was in, we were split up at the time, but she came and participated in family groups, and she had to write me a letter. And so recently, like maybe a couple years ago, I dug the letter out because I hadn't seen it in a long time. And the letter basically said that most of the time when I was gone, because I would disappear for days, you know, and when I most of the time when I when you were gone, I was hoping that I would get a phone call saying you were dead, because I was tired of staying up nights. I was tired of, you know, and that's a hard, really a hard pill to swallow, because right to the bitter end, I thought, you know, I'm still a pretty nice guy, you know. I don't understand what the problem is with, you know, I really didn't understand why she had a problem with me being gone for a couple of days at a time. At least I would call her and let her know that I'm not coming home, you know. You know, it's the disease, when it got to the point, I think, where I couldn't go back, was when I started doing things that I think that at least from this alcoholic's perspective, things that I had promised myself I would never do, you know, cheating on my wife, drinking on the job, you know, not being part of my son. I had my wife and I split up, we had a 6-month-old child who I thought was the, you know, that was my idea of how to save the marriage and, you know, and maybe, save this alcoholic was we'll have a kid. And that didn't work. It doesn't work, I don't think. So, you know, I was doing things that I thought I would never do, you know, when my ex-wife kicked me out of the house, she had to come get me, like, in rapid succession, about 2 or 3 times, had to come get me from jail. And the last time was at 3 o'clock in the morning, and with a, you know, with a young baby with her each time. And on the way home, she said, you've got to go. I can't do this anymore. I'm going to get a divorce. You need to be gone tomorrow when I get home from work. It didn't faze me that much. It certainly didn't faze me enough for me to do anything about it, because I stayed drunk another 18 months after that. My sister was renting a house. She allowed me to move into her basement, and my sister became my drinking buddy for a while until I got a little more out of control. But I stayed drunk 18 more months, you know. So burning my family down to the ground did not get me sober. And what got me sober, I think, was when it got to the point where I was so completely hopeless that I would get up in the morning. I kept the job through all, even though I would disappear for days at a time. Somehow or another, these people let me keep working for them, and I kept the job. I didn't get fired to that job until I was sober, like a year and a half, and deserved it. But I kept the job, but I was not having fun anymore. It was not a lifestyle that it wasn't what I saw my father do. You know, it was not that, you know, I can have a house and have friends over and drink and have fun. It wasn't any of that. Which, you know, tells me that my father wasn't an alcoholic. I am. The day that I got sober really wasn't the day a whole lot different than the bad days I was having. I had been on a weekend with some friends. It was the beginning of July. I came home from that weekend, when everybody else went home, I went to the bar, I got drunk, and when I woke up the next morning, I called my ex-wife we weren't yet divorced, and said, I'm still on your insurance, right? And she said, right. And I said, I think I need some help. She took me to a hospital. I got an assessment, and they told me I was alcoholic, and I was the most surprised person in the room. I had no clue. Alcoholics to me were, and some of you guys are from Chicago, you'll identify more with this than others will, but in Chicago, before Jordan came along and we built the United Center, which is where the Bulls and the Blackhawks play, they played in a place called the Chicago Stadium, which was on Madison, which was Skid Row in Chicago. And so when I was a kid growing up and we would go to hockey games or basketball games or whatever, we would drive by the missions and the drunks would be the guys lying in the door, you know, trying to catch some sleep or trying to get a drink or whatever. That wasn't me. And so when this physician or counselor or whatever she was said that you're an alcoholic, I didn't think so still. But I was so beat up that I decided that I would go to treatment and give it and see what happened. So the first time I ever announced or identified myself as an alcoholic was in treatment. It was the first night I went to treatment, and I sat around in a circle with these guys that most of them who were there already, you know, before I got there. And as they went around the room saying they were alcoholics, I was waiting for it to get to me, and I didn't know what I was going to say. You know, I was probably going to say something like, I'm new, you know. But I didn't. I said I was an alcoholic. And, you know, and it didn't really do anything. This is in treatment. It wasn't Alcoholics Anonymous, you know. And I wasn't really identifying with these guys that didn't want to be there, you know, almost to a man, didn't want to be there. They were there to get their wives back. They were there to get their driver's licenses back. They were there because their kidneys and livers were failing. Whatever reason they were there, they weren't really trying to get sober. They were there for reasons. And it wasn't until I went to my first meeting, or my second meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, actually, that I identified. My first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous was in the basement of a church in a suburb of Chicago. And I had a thing about churches. I hadn't been to one in a long time, and it was kind of spooky. It was a Catholic church, which made it. I converted to Catholicism when I got married, and then I stopped going shortly after that, right? So I go into this. I tell everybody that's my first. I raise my hand and say it's my first meeting, and they drag me outside. The men drag me outside and give me a first step meeting. The reason I didn't identify was that we're sitting outside on a patio, and the whole time I'm thinking, I thought this was an anonymous program. We're sitting outside. The truth is that the street was on the other side of the church. There was nothing behind the church. The truth is it was anonymous. And then as they went around the room, these guys talked, the first three guys all talked about relapsing multiple times, and I'm thinking to myself, these guys are AA members and they can't stay sober. How the hell am I going to stay sober? I didn't identify, and it wasn't their fault, it was my fault. I wasn't ready that first night for whatever reason to hear what I needed to hear. The second AA meeting I went to a club, an Al-Anon club in the suburbs of Chicago, and I was going to sit in the corner, mind my own business, and hope nobody talked to me, you know. And a guy came over and put his hand out and said, "You need to come over here and sit by us." I still don't know what the guy's last name is. They called him Tommy Six. That's all I ever knew him by. I figured there must have been five other Tommies before him or something, so they called him Tommy Six. But he brought me over to where they sat, and these guys started telling me about their problems as it related to alcoholism, you know. And I identified. I could see how they were the same as me. How they seemed like normal guys, you know, but they were sober. And some of them for small amounts of time, and some of them for large amounts of time. And I remember when I got ready to leave, them telling me to keep coming back, and I thought I would, you know. So that's where this topic got me with that one, especially that thing that I had read about identification being the keystone. And you guys have all heard this before, but I feel the need to read it anyway. From the doctor's opinion, it says, "Frothy emotional appeal seldom suffices. The message which can interest and hold these alcoholic people must have depth and weight. In nearly all cases, their ideals must be grounded in a power greater than themselves if they are to recreate their lives." And for me, that was true. I didn't need to hear somebody saying, patting me on the back and telling me, "Don't worry, it's all going to get better." In fact, I remember a guy when I was real new, me asking him, "When's it going to get better?" And he said, "Don't worry, it's going to get different." And he was right. It got real different real soon because this alcoholic, I'm not saying that this is the way everyone does it, but for this alcoholic, I had to cut a whole lot of people out of my life. Those drinkers that I identified with who were my best friends, they weren't really friends, but in my head, they were my best friends. I had to cut them out of my life. I had to start a new life, and I started that new life in Alcoholics Anonymous. And so the guys that were in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous and the women who were in the rooms of Alcoholics Anonymous, became my new friends. And I went to a lot of meetings, and I heard people talking, and some people, you know, didn't want what they had, and some people, I wanted what they had. And I'm grateful for the fact that I got in with a group of guys who were, number one, all about service. And it didn't matter how new I was in the program, I was going to be doing something. So that helped me not have to think about woe is me, because I had a lot of woe is me's. I had court cases. I had, you know, my wife divorcing me. I had a lot of, in my mind, what were woe is me's, and they weren't really that bad. These guys kept me busy, and that kept my mind off it. So they were real involved in service, and they didn't really care about what I had to say. Because I would have rewritten it, you know. I would tell them that I didn't like parts of it, and they would say, "We're not interested in what you have to say, Bill. You said that you want what we have. We don't want what you have," you know. And I'm really grateful to them that it was kind of a no-nonsense. Early on for me, it was kind of a no-nonsense AA. They said, "If you want what we have, you're going to do what we do, and this is what we do." And so we need you to clean the ashtrays, or we need you to make the coffee, or we need you to sweep, you know, afterwards, or we need you to come in here, you know, even when there's not a meeting, and we need you to cook breakfast for these couple hundred people that are going to come in on Sunday mornings. I cooked breakfast on Sunday mornings in this AA club for about the first year that I was sober, almost every Sunday morning. And it, mostly because there was this guy named Frankie B, and Frankie was one of the founders of this club. Frankie would come in and see us. He would come in, one of the first guys that would get there in the morning, and he would look at us and say, "This is where sobriety starts." And that's all I needed to hear. Frankie had been sober a million, in my mind, a million years, you know. I got to go down the road to his funeral. Was the first sober funeral I went to. Died of natural causes, 30-some years sober. You know, I identified with these guys, mostly guys, fortunately, that got me sober. And you know, and I need to, I just got the 3 minutes from Craig, so I want to jump ahead and talk about the guys that are in my life today. Because I told you, eight or 9 years ago, I wouldn't have given it was probably a coin flip whether I was going to hang around or not. I had moved from the suburbs into the city. I met someone who I married. She's in the program. She had all kinds of friends in Chicago AA. My friends were out in the suburbs, you know. And I wasn't really digging Chicago AA when I first got there. Today I wouldn't trade it for anything. But I wasn't, when I first got there, I wasn't liking it. So I started to go into meetings where I would hang in the corner and not talk to anybody. I wasn't putting my hand out to any newcomers. I also wasn't telling the truth because I had lost my driver's license before sobriety. And I'm 8 years sober driving a car without a driver's license. I wasn't telling the truth to my work, to my sponsor, to the other people that I knew in Alcoholics Anonymous until I got arrested. And I got to spend 5 days in Cook County Jail, 8 years sober in Chicago. So that's why I'm saying the people that knew me back then, there was a guy that somebody asked a guy one time about that time about where's Bill been? And he said, "I don't know, but Bill's really dry." You know? And I had a resentment about that guy from the time that he said that, but you know what? He was right. I got hooked up with the guys that are in my home group now. It's a men's group, and it's a wandering men's group. We meet in each other's homes, and these guys are teaching me how to be a man. I'm 51 years old, and in a lot of respects, I have no clue how to be a man. And so I'm surrounding myself with people that have what I want. My sponsor has what I want. He's got a great relationship with his wife. I listen to what he says about his kids, you know, because I have trouble with, I have an 18-year-old who's probably one of us, and I'll quit real quick on this. I have an 18-year-old who's probably one of us, but I can't make that decision for him. All I can do is offer him, you know, the information and let him make that decision, and it's really hard. But I see my sponsor do that with his kid. Who happens to be here today, which is the most amazing thing, you know? And I can just be grateful that my son is in my life and that I love him and that he knows I love him. And if and when he needs Alcoholics Anonymous, he knows where it is because both his father and his stepmother are in Alcoholics Anonymous. And he knows most of my friends, you know? He knows where to go if he needs this program. So I'm just really thrilled to be here with you guys and thrilled to be in San Antonio. Thank you.
Thank you, Bill. Thank you very much. This next lady, I was sitting in the airport in Phoenix, Arizona, and I got this phone call from, I didn't know the number, but I went ahead and took the call, and it was this lady, and she was asking me about this meeting, and she was just asking me about the topic, and I was surprised because, you know, the resourcefulness of alcoholics, because I didn't remember, sending out an email or my phone number. But anyway, she goes, "Well, I got it from him. I just talked to him." So anyways, I thought that was very interesting. Kathleen will have almost 40 years here shortly. So let's give a warm welcome to Kathleen from New Mexico.
Hi, everyone. I'm Kathy Penley from Albuquerque, New Mexico. And I'm a little nervous. I'm from Area 46, District 11, and my home group is the West Side Noon Meeting.
Hi, Kathy.
And my sobriety date is October 20th, 1970. I want to thank Rick and GSO for giving me the honor to do service here. This is my first convention, and I'm having a great time. In honor of our Native American Indians, I'd like to say the Indian prayer that some of our Native Americans say at their meetings. If you'll bear with me. O Great Spirit, whose voice I hear in the winds, and whose breath gives life to all the world to hear, hear me. I come before you, one of your children. I am small and weak. I need your strength and wisdom. Let me walk in beauty and make my eyes ever behold the red and purple sunset. Make my hands respect the things you have made, my ears sharp to hear your voice. Make me wise so that I may know the things that you have taught my people, the lessons you have hidden in every leaf and rock. I seek strength not to be superior to my brother, but to be able to fight my greatest enemy, myself. Make me ever ready to come to you with clean hands and straight eyes, so when my life fades as fading sunset, my spirit may come to you without shame. I was 24 years old and 5 months pregnant with a 2-year-old daughter when I came to AA. And I didn't like the idea that they suggested that I had a drinking problem, but that's what happened. I had no support financially or emotionally at home, and I thought all alcoholics were skid row bums, so I had a lot to learn about alcoholism. One of my uncles was in the state hospital being treated for alcoholism. My father always said, a person who drinks and a drunk is no different, and ladies don't drink. My dad referred to his brother as his drinking brother. I feared being mentally ill, and alcoholism was the same. As a child, I had epileptic seizures. I felt defective, and I was treated different. Dad was the child of an alcoholic, very stern, and today that would be considered abusive. Mom was a very quiet enabler, never standing up for herself or us children. All of this was a recipe for guilt and shame all of my life. As a child, I had to work very hard for my dad's excavation company. We worked sun up to sun down. And I would go to school just being very tired and couldn't think straight. And I was unable to play with the other children because of the epilepsy and because of the work. I resented my siblings for being able to go to work for money at easier jobs. This created drama in my adult life. Our family was very crisis-orientated, and everything was a crisis. And I tried to manipulate a common bond, but it just was not there. When I waded into the rooms of AA, I felt at home and where I belonged. I found people that were friendly and listened to me, something that I never had at home. It was so painful to pour my VO down the sink, yet I was amazed how it cleaned my sink. I got acquainted with a living God that gave me strength and wisdom each day. Hubby took the car, the TV, the dog, and left me with a newborn son. I met a gal at my first meeting who asked me if I had a sponsor, and I said no, and she said she'd be my sponsor. Well, our phone was shut off, and in California you could receive calls, but you couldn't make calls out. So she called me every day at 2:00, and I was fretting beside the phone wondering, you know, is she going to get me caught today? When I needed Al-Anon's babysat for my children so I could get to meetings. And I so appreciated that. They also provided Christmas for my children. And I learned to use the traditions in raising my children. Alcoholism is the only disease that I have that has taught me more about the law, court systems, medical problems, bill collectors, insurance people, hangovers, and ill-fated consequences. I've had to move many times. Some were geographic, and I had numerous major surgeries, relationships, breakups, with a very dysfunctional family, and financial struggles. Yet I haven't found it necessary to take a drink. People at meetings would tell me how sick I was, and I didn't understand what they meant, and I was too scared to ask them. So I committed myself to the same mental hospital that my uncle went through. I never did find out how sick I was or am. I've committed myself two other times to treatment within sobriety because I needed to be in a safe place at the time. I still had a lot of suicidal ideations, and to this day, I haven't had a suicidal ideation in 3 years, and I'm so grateful. I was so tired of being the champion dry drunkard, always trying to fix myself because I felt I had to be perfect. AA has given me more contentment with what I have and what I have not, has taught me to be grateful. I'm getting more mentally and physically healthy each day. I've served as group representative or district reporter, desk helper at central office. Took meetings to prisons and jails, and the prisoners couldn't understand how I stayed sober. But it kept me sober. I was the area editor of our newsletter, and that taught me the most in service about the workings of AA, how our common bond is most important. It is our primary purpose to carry the message to the other suffering alcoholics and to put our own sobriety first. AA has taught me how to take risk and get out of my comfort zone. Since I've sobered up, haven't had any headaches or gut aches, but I never could experience being happy, joyous, and free. So since then, when I was so miserable with myself, I started going to Al-Anon meetings, and that has really helped me a lot because I was always trying to figure out how to fix myself and make things better and be things perfect. You know, I had to define what's this disease and what are the consequences and why can't I get it like other people? And I was always ashamed of my sobriety. I had the length, but I sure didn't feel like I had the quality. And so that's why I do that. And, you know, my family still hasn't come around. They still don't get it. Thank God we sold the ranch and there's not so much bickering and fighting. I'm grateful for our common bond. It keeps me on track with our primary purpose. AA has a very diverse crowd of people to associate with and walk the journey together to recover from alcoholism. AA has and its principles have given me my life. And that's about all I got. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Kathleen. Well, our last gentleman here, I got short-term memory loss here, Michael C. from Georgia. A warm welcome to Michael.
That's the people from the Keys, Florida Keys. My name is Michael, and I am an alcoholic. In the summertime, I'm a member of the One Day at a Time group in Nova Scotia, Canada. But I'm a U.S. citizen, and my home group in Georgia is the Blairsville group. And I'm really grateful to be here and have an opportunity to share with you about our common bond. I want to tell you, in case I forget, because I forget sometime, because it's the most important thing, the single most important thing in my life is, as a result of your sharing with me and the steps of Alcoholics Anonymous, that I have a relationship with God that I never, ever, ever had before and probably couldn't have got any other way. And I'm really grateful for that. And I think that's a lot of the things that binds us together. I want to stop here for just a second and ask you to participate. I think love, joy, acceptance, That's all a part of the things that bond us together. You know, I began thinking, what is it, the steps, the traditions, the concepts? And yes, they all bind us together, for sure. That's part of the bond. But that love and respect and joy is the other thing. So I'm going to ask you all, stand up for a minute, please. Just for a second. Those of you who want to. And then turn around and shake hands or give a hug to somebody next to you. Pass on that love, that warmth. All right, okay. All right, thank you very much. I think that that's one of the things that helps bond us together. You know, I'm going to talk to you a little bit about my experience, and that's all I can share with you. Somebody told me early in my sobriety that joy was an undeniable sign of the presence of God, and I go along with that. When I've not got a certain amount of joy in my life, I am certainly not in tune with God. And my sharing today is going to be a little bit about how I got there, because I didn't start off there for sure. I was selfish and self-centered in the extreme. I came from a family of alcoholism, and there's a lot of joy in that today. There wasn't then, as I was growing up, but there is now. My dad got sober in 1954, and my older brother got sober in 64. And my sobriety date is the 2nd of February, 1970. And for that, I'm grateful to God and you all. I like to brag about it. It's such a joy. It really is. I can't even, some of you know it. There are four generations of us in AA now. In November of 2008, my oldest son started going to AA, and he was the 21st member that found a 12-step program. And I'm so grateful to you all and all those 12-step programs for being there for them when they needed it and for me. When I was a child, Mother used to take us to church. And I pretty much learned quick that you could walk in one door and out the other. Before I did that, I was an Episcopalian, so we kneeled a lot and stood and sat and listened and everything, sang and stood and sang, and whenever I was kneeling, I looked around at the people there, and I didn't have whatever they had. Now, some of them had an attractive-looking life. They had some peace and some joy in their life, and it was sincere, and you could tell it. And some of them I judged as phony, you know, my own judgment, but that's where I was coming from. But, you know, I wasn't like them, and so I didn't fit in at church either. But I felt something there. And so as I went along in life, I was the child that Mother could get up in the morning to go to early service with. I went with her regularly for years. Matter of fact, in my early married life, I couldn't hardly stay in bed, hangover or not, to go to church. And I pretty much quit that early on. But I got in a big habit of going. Anyhow, it didn't do me much good because I didn't understand the language. You know, with Dad's alcoholism, I wanted to be a different man and a different husband and a different father. And, you know, I didn't know that I didn't have the qualities to do that. Somehow or another, I had missed them growing up. I began drinking with intention when I was probably 14 or 15 years old. I'm sure it was about 14. And I never will forget it because it really bugged me. I used to try and at Christmas time and Thanksgiving and around New Year's, a lot of the friends that I ran around with, their families had little punch bowls with eggnog in it, and I kept trying to find something, and I never found the right combination in the eggnog. And I tried them all, As I got a little older, I tried it in cans. I tried it in sanitary packs, all kinds of things that I tried to find the eggnog that tasted good. Something was wrong with it. And, you know, I didn't find out until I was sober and doing some inventory work that my first drink was when I was about 5 years old and about that high to a table, and there was a punch bowl on it that had been spiked. And I know to this day it was, you know, it took my breath away as a child. But that drink at 5 years old, I was looking for when I was a teenager. You know, so something inside of me was different. Certainly didn't get drunk when I was a five-year-old, but it set up something in me that I never forgot and started looking for when I was really uncomfortable in my skin and my life. I had some experiences as a child where I felt abandoned. All of us do, I'm sure, one time or another. I felt shamed. I felt like it was wrong to express my feelings. And I carried that on into my life. And I desperately needed approval. I was a skinny kid all my life, the little, you know, the comic book guy who gets his sand kicked in his face by the big muscular guy. Well, I was a skinny guy, and I just didn't fit in anywhere. I had a lot of fear of rejection. I didn't fit in school. I had ADD. I didn't learn to read until I was about the fourth grade because I had mirrored vision. Nobody in those days knew about that. Part of my ADD was I had very difficult with short-term retention. And I never paid any attention to the instructions or the rules. I couldn't remember them. So I just figured I'd figure it out as I went along. And that's kind of how my life was, trying to figure out what you all expected of me and how I should respond so that I would be acceptable. I began having blackouts early in my sobriety. I didn't have a lot of them, but any time I could drink most of a fifth in an evening's drinking, I had a blackout. I found out early that if I drank more than half a dozen cans of beer, I'd get sick, and I didn't like that, so I went straight to whiskey. I liked it. I liked that burning feeling. It used to swish it around my mouth, and I liked that burning feeling. Get a little, mouth starts watering now when I think about it. But, you know, I guess that's just reflex action. I don't know. But anyhow, so I drank because I liked the effect. You know, and I know what it did. I didn't really understand it in those days, but I didn't care what I thought you were thinking about me whenever I started drinking. You know, it was I don't give a damn attitude, and just selfish and self-centered in the extreme. I had a fear of rejection by girls, so I hooked on to one at about 15, and me and Mickey were married and had our family together, and grew up in sobriety, I'll say that. That was a rocky road like it is for all of us. Even with a sober father in AA, and I had seen and been around AA meetings since I was 14 years old. And, anyhow, you know, it didn't make any difference. I was different. I tell you that the other thing, I didn't even feel like I was a member of the family. I wondered at times if I was adopted. You know, my learning disability made me different in school. My feelings about what was going on in church made me feel different, and I just was different. And so I knew I was different than Dad and Alan. My older brother expressed himself with his emotions, slammed doors, hit the wall, yelled. And not me, I stuffed my feelings. And I hated that expression. It always intimidated me whenever Alan blew off steam. And I found when I was about 16 probably that I started using alcohol to do for me what I couldn't do myself for myself. I intentionally got my pint so that I would be able to go to the dance and fit in, and I knew that. I needed that help. I could not do it without it myself. And, you know, I began to use alcohol to do for me what I couldn't do for myself. Mickey and I got married at 19 and started raising our family. And, you know, I found out another major thing that had guided that part of my life, and that is I had not prepared to be a father, a husband, a companion. And here I was married with a child coming on, and You know, I worked in the family business. I was afraid to go out and go work somewhere else. I took what I thought was the easier, softer way, which turned out, we were a seasonal business, and you really did owe your soul to the company store. When the doors were open, you were there, and we opened early and closed late. And then when the season was off, we worried about it. Didn't have any money, you know. So if it wasn't one thing, it was another. I reached a point where my drinking progressed like it does for all of us. Like I told you, I was having blackouts. I didn't get a lot of static from my wife about it because talking to her later in my early sobriety, she said, "Well, I thought you ought to know your dad was an alcoholic, your brother." I told her, "Not me. I just like it. What the heck? If I couldn't have a drink now and then, what's life all about? Work hard." By the time I got into my mid-20s, things were getting worse and worse and worse. And I was at that point where I very seldom got home when I said I would. Whenever I stopped for a couple, I just never got there. Sometimes I didn't get there till 4 or 5 or 6 in the morning where I just kind of changed clothes and go back to work. We weren't getting along. The kids made me nervous. When I did get home, the few evenings I got home and they were still up, I didn't understand what was going on. I had not been a part of their upbringing. I'd been working harder drinking. When I got home, I wanted to get the newspaper and read the newspaper and have a few drinks and have my dinner and go to bed, have sex or whatever, and get up and go and start all over again tomorrow. That was what my life was all about. But I'd come home and they'd be running all around the living room, jumping on the furniture, and I didn't understand it. It made me nervous. I was providing the roof over the head and food and clothes, and you know what I know now, though? They were beginning to exhibit some of the fears I had that I didn't even know about, and I started seeing it in them. And the other major thing, all they wanted was for me to love them and have an interest in them. And I couldn't do that. I was just too self-centered. All that brings about a soul sickness. A soul sickness. There wasn't any joy in my life. I was trying to control everything around me. And not succeeding very well. Not wanting to admit that or accept it. But I kept struggling with it. And like I say, by the time I got to even my mid-20s, whenever I took a drink in the afternoon, and I took a lot of afternoon drinks, I just didn't ever know what was going to happen. I didn't understand that. I didn't think it was a problem. But she kept saying, if I'd only come home, if I'd only bring the paycheck home, if I would just help her with the kids. And she began pointing out things, and she was right, and I knew it. So I decided, okay, all right. She was talking or thinking about divorce, and it wasn't working, and I didn't want to get a divorce. I'd have been the first one in the family. Pride had me there, thank God, to a point. So I decided the only way I was going to get home was to not drink. I didn't think I had a problem, but I knew when I drank, I didn't get home. So I quit drinking. I'd been to Dale Carnegie, and I believed I could do anything in the world I wanted to if I wanted to bad enough. One time I told my wife there was a pack of matches on the nightstand. I said, "See that pack of matches? If I think hard enough, I can probably make it move." I was really off in my own egotistical world. And I didn't drink for about 3 months. And it was probably the most painful, miserable time in my entire life. Depression, self-loathing, looking to pick fights with her until I could go out and drink again. It was terrible. It was hell. I couldn't imagine anything worse, even if I ever died or when I do die. I love my hell right then here on earth, I'll tell you. I had to have a drink. We were on a business trip. She went with me. I had to have a drink. I needed a drink. My teeth needed a drink. I already knew now because I've gone to, I've been around my dad, and his club had barbecues and picnics and functions, and I knew, and my brother told me about taking that one drink. If you can only take one drink, you're not an alcoholic. Well, I tried that. I went into a bar one time, and remembering what my brother told me, and I sat at the bar, and I'd have me a double. And I sat there 20 or 30 minutes, 20 minutes maybe, and nothing happened, so I just, but I thought I'd pass the test. You know, I mean, I thought I'd pass the test. And anyhow, I had to have that drink and on this business trip with my wife, and I blacked out quick this time. I stopped and just got a half pint and then went back in there before I left the parking lot and bought a fifth. And I don't know how long I drank in a blackout and drove, but I was driving and drinking. And I came out of the blackout, and I was getting ready to kill her. I was going to take that bottle and break it and just stab her with it. The rage I had inside of me and anger at her and myself for not being the man I wanted to be and for her pointing out things I didn't want to look at. And I didn't do that, of course. The highway patrolman in our community stopped by, and I threw the bottle out the window. And in those days, they knew you, so they let me go. And they knew my dad, too, you know, small town. And it was the first time that I had a bad, bad, bad hangover. I didn't have hangovers, usually. I never got sick or threw up, you know. I used to have the aches. My joints ache, my knees ache. And sometimes I get the runs, kind of like the flu. Until about 10 or 11 in the morning, and I'd get out of it, and I'd be all right. But this time, the hangover hung on. And you know, I thought I was crazy, full of depression, you know, misery, unhappiness, no joy at all. And so here I was going to kill my wife, right? So I went to a psychiatrist. I knew, you know, and I'd much rather been crazy than to not have, you know, then I could drink sometime, but instead of being an alcoholic, which I knew they didn't drink, you know. And anyhow, I went to him for 3.5 years, and I didn't drink. And he prescribed it to me, some much-needed over-the-counter, prescribed medication. And I began to use it. And I'm the kind of guy, if one's good, two's better. I never took one of those pills. He gave some to my wife, and I took hers also. And you know, I had figured out how to always have them in my pocket. And so I did that until September of 1969. And I had my last drink in 1966, but I don't count that because of those pills. And I started going to meetings because I was spending some time with a fellow who began to share his life with me. He wasn't trying to help me or save me. I hadn't had a drink in a long time. I didn't know what powerlessness over alcohol was. I saw alcoholics. I had no idea about powerless over alcohol. But Ray shared his life with me. I would sit in his camper and drink coffee. I won't go home. We were arguing and fighting. And anyhow, and there were stories were funny, and I'd laugh and he'd laugh, and we had a great relationship. And Ray, finally, I asked him one time. I said, Ray, what did you do? He says, well, I went to Alcoholics Anonymous. I took those 12 steps and my life changed. I said, well, you think it'll work for me? He says, I don't know. He says, if you'll come on and go with me to some meetings, we'll find out. And I did that. I'll tell you, in 1966, when I had my last drink, I went to a few AA meetings, but I was not like you. You know, we're talking to one another a mile a minute. I didn't know what you were talking about. You were drinking coffee, and I wasn't big into coffee yet. And I knew you did not love your families, or you wouldn't be here. Because I thought if you love your families, you would go home to them every night, right? You were just trying to get away from them like I'd been doing. Anyhow, and I wasn't like you, because I wanted to be a good husband and father, you know. Like I said before, I didn't have the qualities of a good husband and father. There's no way in the world I could be that. But I started going to meetings with Ray in September of 1969. Popping pills, and I'd take a couple of pills about 7:30, and the meetings in our town at that time were at 8:30, and I could talk good like the rest of you. I got a little mush mouth over it, but I could talk like the rest of you. And, of course, a little after 8, I'd take one more just to be sure, you know. thank God for Pappy Sam. Pappy took me aside one time after I'd been going to meetings 3 or 4 weeks, and he said, Michael, he said, come here, boy. He was in a wheelchair. He was an old man, all shriveled up. And he says, I've been watching you. He says, you're chewing your booze. He says, you're taking a mind-altering substance. It's going to do exactly that. And if you don't want to drink, you better not do it anymore. Whew, I heard that. He got my attention, and I heard it. I didn't want to drink ever again because I was afraid if I drank again, I'd wake up from one of them blackouts and find my whole family dead or something crazy. And so I put the pills down, and all that hell was still there. And I had a drunk dream. Thank God for the drunk dream, where I had had a bad day at work, went home, started a fight with my wife in this dream, stomped out of the house, got in the car, went to the liquor store, got my bottle, and I was off and running. And it was the first time I saw the pattern. It'd been there hundreds of times. I'd done it hundreds of times, but I never acknowledged it. But this dream woke me up. And when I came out of the dream, I had to ask my wife, did I drink? Because I felt like it. My joints ached again, and I just felt terrible. And I hadn't. And so I went down to the club where my then sponsor, who I never talked to. I had a sponsor, though. It was a guy named Ennis, NSP. He was a big construction worker guy, bald-headed, used to wax his head, and big muscular man. I wanted Ennis to run my life for him, but I never gave him a chance. I never would talk to Ennis, but I did ask him this time, what was I going to do? He said, well, dummy, that's what Alcoholics Anonymous is for. He says, are you powerless over alcohol? And I understood powerless in the first phase for me. And what I understood is when I put a drink in my mouth, I was powerless. It set off that compulsion, and I could not, had no control over it. You know, today I know that I'm powerless right this very minute. And circumstances with arguments with my wife are the beginning of a drunk, maybe. Ha ha. You know, where does it start? The sixth drink, the first drink, when you buy the bottle, where does it start? Well, for me, it starts today, right this minute, you know. I messed around with the steps for a long time trying to do it my way. I was trying to take the steps to manage my life with them. But I know today, and I know, found out early enough in my sobriety, that the steps for me were to help me find a relationship with God who would solve my problems for me. You know, I am powerless over alcohol. And when I practice those 12 steps today, I find things I'm powerless over today. I tell you, my first wife and I started off when we were real young. And she died in 2005 after we'd been married for 47 years. I'm grateful for God for that relationship. I will tell you, though, a psychiatrist told us one time when we were going to the psychiatrist to straighten our children out that we had a valid relationship. I was so glad that he said that. Well, I had a lot of questions about us and things. And the next time I went back, I said, you said we had a valid relationship. Can you explain that? He says, oh, sure. He says, your sicknesses complement one another. You know, we really did grow up together in recovery, though. And I will tell you that I'm sober partly because of the Al-Anon family groups. And I'm so grateful to God that they were there for her. She found recovery in spite of me. You know, new alcoholics, young alcoholics, new ones, got wives. You can blame them, boy. They got a lot of things you can blame about them. Because when I got sober in the beginning, she never got dressed up in the morning. The house was never really doing well. She was always whining about something. But she got herself an Al-Anon sponsor and an AA gal to help sponsor her. And her life began to change. And I couldn't blame her anymore. And it really was the thing that forced me into looking at myself. You know, I reached a point where sober in AA, doing everything I thought I ought to be doing, copying you all, reading the books, working on committees, selling raffle tickets, all the things that we can do, staying sober on the fellowship, loving the strokes, but not recovering from the disease of alcoholism. And I finally got a man to help me do the steps. And it really has been a process for me of finding God and growing up. For me, the steps are a maturing process. I've begun to have a little more patience and tolerance, particularly when I saw how weak and fallible I was as I did inventory work. And as I talked to sponsors about this, I'll tell you, if I didn't have a sponsor when I started my fourth step, I would not have survived. I was so full of anger and rage that I'd stuffed all those years that I needed to have somebody to talk to as I went along. And Chico, thank God, really helped me through all that time. He helped me also look at the exact nature of my wrongs. And after one of my fifth steps, because I did a couple of them with him before I really got it all down, I went home and reread it. And I'll tell you, I was entirely ready to have somebody remove all that from me. It was sickening. I was nauseated to see how my selfish self-centeredness, my lack of consideration, everything, my gluttony, my greed, my envy, all those things would cause all the problems in my life, the way they manifested themselves. And I was entirely ready to have somebody remove them from me. And then I tried to get good. I was going to do it. I'll fix it. Of course, I got the seventh step, and that's what that was about for me. Because I continually have to be humbled again. And that's a good thing for me, to turn to God as the solution to all my problems. You know, I started off talking to you about the bond. And I think that it's a spiritual bond for us. It's the love I feel coming from you, coming from every meeting I ever sat in my life. You know, I'm so grateful. I have a sister who's not an alcoholic, but all the rest of my family members are, but she never found it. She wasn't beaten down so that God could take her and remake her, right? She's coming. She's in her 60s now, and she's doing okay. She's doing fine. But I'm so grateful to God for what we have had as a fellowship and for this bond that's tied me to you. You know, I'm going to end my talk with a couple of little things. There's two stories. There's one story, and I'm going to tell you the story. And I like the way I tell it, so I'm going to tell it. There's these two guys, and they were anonymous. And this was 2,000 years ago, a long time ago, right? And they had a guy who was a friend of theirs, I guess, and he was so sick that they had him on a stretcher. They never did tell you their names. I mean, they were anonymous, right? But they had a belief, and their belief was if they took this man to where the message was, that maybe he would be healed. So this guy that they wanted him to hear, somebody they referred to as the absolute spiritual truth, the Christ, that's what they meant, absolute spiritual truth. And they tried to go through the door in the house where he was sharing and talking, and they couldn't get in. They tried to go through a window, and they couldn't get in there, so they climbed up on the roof, and they moved some of the roof tiles aside and lowered the guy down. And he told them that it was by their faith that he would be healed. And I'll tell you, it's your faith, your openness, your love for me, and the new guys coming through the door, your willingness to bare your soul that I could identify with it and find myself, that I've been healed. And I'm really grateful to God for that. You know, I heard a guy say it today, and it's a fact, that I saw it in my soul as I was going along through life, and a soul I couldn't see. And I sought God, and God eluded me, and I sought you all in the 12 steps, and I found all three. Thank you for letting me share.